So this is great because, well, complain to the organizers if you want, but I get to give the third talk today on exactly the same topic. And the talk by Sung-Soo Kim, I think, was a bit on the pessimistic side. The talk by Simon was rather exuberantly optimistic. And of course, I'm going to give you now a completely objective and neutral assessment of this scenario. I'm going to concentrate on work that we've been doing at Northwestern on this problem. There are really two aspects here and two different projects. One was done, and this is really a heroic effort by Mark Freitag over the last 2 years to study in extreme details the actual process, the physics of this runaway collisions that can happen in the cores of young star clusters, and the growth of the object that we think will eventually collapse to form an intermediate mass black hole. And then another project, which I will actually spend most of my time on, which was the last chapter in the PhD thesis of Atakan Gorkhan, which considers this scenario, the runaway collisions and formation of the 9BH, in the context of the galactic center problem. So let me just go through the outline of my talk. I'm going to spend just about 1 minute reminding you about what this scenario is, since we've now heard quite a bit about it. And then I will tell you about our latest results from these Monte Carlo simulations. People have not spent much time discussing numerical methods here. Let me just say that these Monte Carlo type simulations are a way of doing n-body simulations for very large stellar systems, of course, under certain approximations, in particular Fokker-Planck type approximation and also spherical symmetry of the potential. And as I will try to emphasize in this talk, in the particular context of the galactic center problem, I think it is important to be able to look at the evolution of fairly large star clusters. Hence the need for this rather different numerical approach. So I'll spend most of my time on what is actually now the second bullet here, which is to tell you about our calculations using this Monte Carlo method for the evolution of large means here up to several millions of solar masses, large young star clusters that might undergo this process of inspiral into the galactic center and on the way form through runaway collisions an intermediate mass black hole. And then at the end, if there's time, I will tell you a little bit about this very recent work, I mean recent in the sense that the two papers have just come out on AstroPH, with Mark Freitag trying to understand the basic physics of these runaway collisions and characterize it better. So just to remind you very, very quickly of what the basic ideas are here, we are trying to explain the presence of these young stars in the inner parsec of the galactic center region by saying that they formed, in fact, much further out. And much further, you've realized already if you paid attention, means different things for different people. To Simon, much further might mean only, say, a couple of parsecs. I'm going to push this out with the work that we've done here to possibly several tens of parsecs, as you will see in a minute. So these stars could have formed much further away in star clusters that then undergo this process of inspiral driven by dynamical friction. It's been known for a while that unless you consider clusters that are rather extreme in terms of their central densities in particular, they will disrupt in the tidal field of the galactic center well before they inject any young stars into the inner parsec, certainly deep into the inner parsec. Hence the idea that was suggested, discussed recently by Hansen and Milosavljevic, that if on the way during the inspiral these clusters actually form a central massive black hole, then you have a way of basically preventing the complete disruption. You can attach some of these young stars in a cusp around the central massive black hole, and then when the cluster finally disrupts, you're still left with something in the middle that's massive enough that it will continue to inspiral and presumably leave behind these massive stars somewhere in the region of interest. Okay, that's the summary of the basic scenario. I don't want to say more about it. I would like to spend a few minutes on this plot, which nobody has shown before. This was kind of what Simon was showing in the last 30 seconds of his talk. This shows the full parameter space of the problem. So what's along the x-axis here is the initial mass of the star cluster, going from 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6, possibly 10 to the 7 here, solar masses. And along the vertical axis is where the cluster forms initially, distance from the galactic center, 1 parsec, 10 parsec, possibly many tens of parsecs in this upper region. There are quite a number of conditions that clusters have to satisfy for this scenario to work. The most obvious one is that the dynamical friction time, the in-spiral time, has to be short enough. Short enough here means short compared to the lifetime of the young stars of interest, depending on which stars you're talking about in the inner parsec. That could be somewhere between a few million years for the most massive ones, up to maybe 10 million years for the inner cluster stars. So if you take that ratio, and you all we've done here, this is very simple. You can do this in a more sophisticated way if you want, but this is just within a factor of a few. You can calculate this in spiral time, assuming that the mass of the cluster is constant. In other words, this is just a point mass approximation. But you can use the latest, this is what we've done here, you can use the latest determination of the mass distribution in the galactic center region. And you get these two lines, and so the first condition that's very obvious is that the requirement on the time scales, that the cluster has to start in this region here, somewhere below these lines. Then the second condition, if you want the intermediate mass black hole to have formed at the center of the cluster as it undergoes the in-spiral, is that the core collapse time for the cluster has to be less than the in-spiral time. Now, the basic physics of what drives a young star cluster to core collapse very rapidly, we're talking here about timescales again of a few million years, is by now very well understood. There have been quite a number of studies of this over the last few years. And the result that has emerged from essentially all of these studies is that there's a simple relationship between the core collapse time and the central relaxation time of the cluster. And roughly speaking, the core collapse time is something like 0.1 times the central initial relaxation time in the core of the cluster. So all we have to do is, for each cluster, determine what the initial central relaxation time is, and then we can convert that into a core collapse time relatively easily. The physics, by the way, again, hasn't been discussed very much. I don't have quite the time to do it. But the physics of this very fast core collapse is actually rather simple. It is driven by the mass segregation of the most massive stars that have formed in the cluster. Mass segregation can be very fast because stars can be very massive compared to the average, up to a factor of 100 in principle. And then the thing that really drives the cluster to core collapse eventually is this well-known Spitzer instability. At some point, you concentrate so many of the massive stars in the core of the cluster that they basically decouple dynamically from the rest of the system. And then you end up with a much smaller n-body system at the center, which has a much, much shorter relaxation time, and then the evolution is very fast. Okay. So these lines here, the dashed lines, now show the condition that the core collapse time has to be less than the in-spiral time, and this depends only on the degree of central concentration initially in the cluster. So one assumption here I should have mentioned, it was mentioned by the previous speakers, is the standard one to make in this context, is that the cluster, you notice nowhere do I specify what the density is or what the radius of the cluster is. These clusters are all assumed to be always at their tidal radius. Okay? So if I tell you what the mass of the cluster is and what the distance is from the center of the galaxy, you know what the tidal radius is there, and that's what we assume for the radius of the cluster. So the only parameter you need to know that specifies, that allows you to calculate now the core collapse time, is something that measures the central concentration of the density profile. And here we use, just for simplicity, King models, and so this W-naught parameter of the King model tells you about central concentration. High W-naught means very centrally concentrated. Low W-naught means a more uniform kind of density profile. Okay. So the first point I want to make here is that the allowed region of parameter space for this scenario is pretty big. And in the absence of good constraints observationally on what the right initial conditions are for these young clusters, I think it's important theoretically to consider the whole region, in principle, the whole region of the allowed parameter space. In particular, if you're willing to consider rather centrally concentrated structures, that means you're going to go all the way to possibly very massive clusters, many millions of solar masses, perhaps up to 10 to 7 solar masses, and you can put them, in that case, quite far away, up to tens of parsecs, say, in this upper region right here. Now, there's another requirement, and this goes back to many of the questions that Simon got, which I didn't put on this diagram, and has to do with the mass of the intermediate mass black hole that you want to get in the end. For quote-unquote normal clusters, meaning clusters that are not initially collisional, we know very well the relationship between the mass of the black hole that you get from the runaway process and the initial mass of the cluster. And that's what was mentioned before at the beginning of Simon's talk. It's about 10 to the minus 3. So if you want to end up with an intermediate mass black hole, that's at least 1,000 solar masses. This is what Hansen and Milosavljevic have told us is sort of the minimum if you want the in-spiral to continue fast enough. You need an initial cluster mass that's somewhere around 1 million solar masses. So I could have drawn another line in this diagram right here telling you that, you know, the cluster has to be in this more massive region here. You see these points here. These are from the results of our numerical Monte Carlo simulations. This is clearly the region that we have concentrated on in our work at Northwestern. The kinds of calculations that Simon was showing you using direct n-body simulations really is more concentrated in this region here. Now, the reason for that, if I wanted to be nasty to him, is that that's all n-body simulations can do. Okay? But I don't want to be nasty to him. Now, let me show you a little bit of the physics and then get to the more interesting questions and results at the end. This is just to show you what happens during the in-spiral. And here, these are still semi-analytic calculations. They're not in the point mass limit, but we treat the mass from the cluster. Okay? So we assume a constant structure for the cluster, but we do take into account the fact that the tidal boundary is eating into the density profile. Okay? It's sort of the next level of semi-analytic calculation that you can do. And this shows simply the evolution of this shows the spiral in, where the cluster is in terms of its distance from the galactic center as a function of time. And this is just to illustrate again what's been said many times, that this spiral in can certainly occur on a fairly short time scale of a few million years. You notice here that clusters of different masses in this approximation all end up disrupting at exactly the same radius. This is something you can show by scaling on the back of an envelope. But of course what happens is that more massive clusters undergo in spiral faster, even though they all end up in the end at the same place, disrupting. And then clusters that are more centrally concentrated, meaning higher values of this W naught parameter, of course end up disrupting closer to the center. Okay? Now, if you put all of this together, you can get an idea of where it's possible to end up with these clusters, and this is really independent of whether the massive black hole actually forms or not. So these lines now summarize sort of many of the previous types of calculations as a function of W naught here, and this is sort of the full reasonable range of initial conditions from very uniform to very centrally concentrated. This is the final disruption radius for different initial radii, and remember within this approximation it's independent of the mass of the cluster. Okay, so this is just to make the point, again made by many people before, that it's quite possible to end up well within the inner parsec region. It is, however, important, even just to track the in-spiral, to take into account the internal dynamical evolution of the cluster. This is something that there's some conflicting statements in the literature about this. This is just to show you an example, a particular cluster, which you can track in three different ways. This is, again, radius as a function of time. This is the point mass approximation, just following a constant mass spiraling into the galactic center. Okay, this is the approximation I mentioned before, where you actually take into account the tidal truncation and the mass loss, so then the cluster disrupts somewhere. And this is our full stereodynamics Monte Carlo simulation, the solid line here. Okay, so it does make quite a bit of a difference whether or not you treat correctly the internal dynamical evolution of the cluster, particularly near the end, of course, where all the mass loss is happening. The final disruption is rather fast. And it matters maybe not at the level of an order of magnitude, but at the level of some rather large factor. Okay, I'm sort of justifying why we actually bother to do full stereodynamic simulations here. These are, of course, very costly. This plot, I believe, has actually been flashed quickly by one of the previous speakers. This is to show you what's left typically at the end, at the moment of disruption. So here, this is a cluster that has followed this scenario. It has formed a massive black hole at the center. It has gone all the way to the point of disruption. And at the point of disruption, we're left with this cusp of stars that are still bound to the central massive black hole. And of course, one important question is, what are these stars? And here I show the mass function in the solid line. This is the mass function of the stars that are left bound to the massive black hole at the end, compared to the simple saltpeter-like IMF that we had used for the cluster in our initial condition. And of course, what you see, this is largely what you expect, is that there is a very strong enhancement in the number of massive stars. So massive stars are very much preferentially retained in this cusp at the end. That's, of course, good. That's one of the main points of this scenario. But contrary to what you will sometimes read in the literature, it is not that you find only massive stars in this cusp. And in fact, you cannot even say that the cusp is dominated by massive stars. If you have anything like a normal saltpeter type IMF, of course, most of the stars are still going to be lower mass stars in this cusp. Here is really, I told you I would be unbiased, so I've told you what was the problem with considering smaller clusters, the kinds of calculations that Simon was showing you, in order to form a massive enough black hole, starting from a cluster that might be only, what was the value used by Simon in one of his calculations, 50,000 solar masses. If you use a normal initial condition for a cluster that's only 50,000 solar masses, you're going to end up with a black hole that's basically non-existent. Okay, the 10 to the minus 3 would tell you 50 solar masses, but basically nothing happens. The only way that you can make it work, and this is what Simon et al. Have done, is to make the cluster extremely compact initially, extremely dense, so that collisions basically start right away. Now, whether that's realistic or not, I don't know, but certainly one thing it's telling you is that basically you shouldn't be doing stereodynamics anymore. You should be doing star formation. I mean, as the stars are formed in one of those smaller clusters, say at 2 parsecs, they would start colliding right away as they form. Okay, these are the kinds of ideas that some of the people studying star formation have been talking about for years now, Kathy Clark, Ian Bonnell, and collaborators, that the process of physical collisions are actually important during the star formation process, may even be responsible for shaping the upper mass of the IMF. Okay. But, you know, these might not be realistic initial conditions. Now, if you go to what I see as the easier way of doing this, and you go to bigger clusters that start further away, and they're not particularly extreme in their initial conditions, the problem you have is an embarrassment of riches. This is illustrated here. If you assume that the IMF is uniform in the cluster, meaning that you distribute the stars according to mass in the same way everywhere, close to the, in the halo of the cluster and near the center of the cluster, of course, as the cluster spirals in, it dribbles out stars all the time. Mass segregation helps in that, on that time scale, it tends to concentrate the more massive stars towards the center, but you will still lose many massive stars along the way, all the way. So if you're starting, say, from 10 parsecs, you start losing massive stars throughout that region, from 10 parsecs down to 1 or 0.1 or wherever you end up. So here is an example here from one of our simulations that's sort of typical. This was for a 2 million solar mass cluster that we started at somewhere around 20 parsecs, I think. And these are numbers of stars of different masses that we were left along the way. If you look at the most massive stars, say above 60 solar masses, it's this dashed line here. Most of them are indeed lost at the end, near the point of tidal disruption, but you lose many at, you know, 4, 6, 8 parsecs. And these, the observers tell us, are really not there. How you hide them, I don't know. One way, perhaps, which I think was mentioned this morning, maybe I mentioned it, initial mass concentration, initial mass segregation. People who study young star clusters and also theorists who think about star formation in clusters tell us that massive stars in clusters should form preferentially near the center of the cluster. If that were the case, of course, you protect them from being lost along the way through tidal stripping, and perhaps you end up with just one big spike where all the massive stars are injected into the environment right at the end instead of all along the way. Right. What is that secret weapon? Well, I'll just keep talking and we'll see.
The secret weapon is both of us at once.
You'll show me, okay, good. Come, sit here. Oh, I want to see that. So just in a 2 minute, basically I'll just make it an advertisement then for these two gigantic papers that were just put on AstroPH, and I should say really 99% of the work in these papers was done by Mark Freitag. This is a very, just to impress on you that we understand quite well the physics of this runaway growth process. Okay, this is whole parameter space that sort of illustrates the kinds of calculations that we've done. This is the mass of the cluster, and this is the length scale, or characteristic size of the cluster. Covering this wide parameter space, I'll just say that all the dots that you see here correspond to calculations that we've done, and wherever you see a full solid dot as opposed to an open one means that we found a runaway. Okay, so there's a large region, you know, over many orders of magnitudes in initial conditions that suddenly give you runaways. And then just, let me just end by flashing this and telling you that if you want to know more about this work, you can go and talk to Mark Freitag, who's right here for the conference. In this work, for the first time, we have actually tracked in details all the individual collisions that happen between stars as the runaway growth process takes place. In particular, in some of the simulations, we've used the database of 3D hydrocalculations that Mark had built for his PhD thesis, which gives you sort of the ultimate realism or state-of-the-art in the treatment of individual collisions based on actual hydrodynamics. This is just a typical example of how this runaway progresses. You know, typically one big guy will at some point start colliding repeatedly with smaller stars, and just keeps growing very, very fast. This is the time scale here at the end, mass as a function of time. You see how quick this process becomes here, and we end up with an object that's, in this case, something like a couple of thousand solar masses. The big uncertainty here, the huge question mark in all of these studies, is that, of course, we all assume that this thing, by the time it's a few thousand solar masses, it's got to collapse to a black hole, and we all happily call it a black hole. But this is, of course, still highly uncertain. And people here like Chris Fryer, who's in the audience, who actually thinks seriously about these things, will tell you that, you know, the physics is by no means totally understood. So I'll leave it at that.
At the back.
Well, the more you concentrate the massive stars in the core of the cluster to begin with, the more you're going to get, the more you're going to tend to get the runaway. So you can't avoid it. I mean, it's not so much a question of whether you want it or not. You can't avoid it. I mean, the physics is there. Relaxation is happening. Collisions are happening. Things are. You don't have that much freedom in the context of the galactic center because, again, if you give me a mass and you give me a radius, I know the tidal radius, so that sets the density. And, you know, you can play a bit with the density profile, clearly, the more you concentrate the massive stars in the core to begin with, the faster they're going to start colliding, and the more you're going to get this thing to grow and become a 1,000 solar mass blob. In a large region of this parameter space here, which is, I mean, at least the parameter space is well determined, if not necessarily the outcome, I think you really cannot avoid the runaway process. Okay, you could still say that, you know, maybe we don't understand mass loss from a 1,000 solar mass star, and perhaps it really doesn't form a 1,000 solar mass black hole at the end.
But, okay.
Yeah, but that would that. Yeah. No, but if you are in the region that I described at the beginning, you know, then the time scale is short enough, and that's a pretty big region.
Question at the front here.
What actually happens when my core comets cross the proximity mass of the hole? I mean, I would expect lots of highly disrupted stars and a firework of things going off. So, I mean, there should be some signal. I mean, if I have a cluster starting in there forming an intermediate mass, the total 1,000 solar masses in the core of this cluster, I must get a lot of highly disrupted stars and fireworks going off. I always miss that part.
You mean, what would you see as an observer if you caught this phase in the act?
I don't know. I just
where is it?
They don't just quietly.
Well, the collisions, the stellar collisions, you know, it's extremely unlikely that you're going to catch a stellar collision in the act. You may be asking, would you see the supernova explosion or something when this 2,000 solar mass object actually forms a black hole? Maybe Chris Fry wants to comment about this. The folklore that I'm just going to repeat is that by the time you're at that high a mass, the collapse is largely silent. This is just monolithic collapse, and just everything goes down into a black hole, and there is really no supernova.
Tal here.
I've noticed that on the mass axis at the last one, so in the base phase, you go up to 10-day solar, not just one, you go to 10-day solar mass. These are dwarf galaxies by your own black. Generally speaking, I'm impressed by the fact that you're pushed to really very high masses for these structures.
I don't know where you saw 10 to the 8 solar masses. We haven't gone much.
With all the lines going all the way to.
Of course. But if you want to do this in general.
Sure, but I mean, generally, you are dealing with very massive distance. Are you bothered by the fact that you are moving to a quantum parameter space where.
No, 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 no. Just, yeah, I'll let Mark. Yeah, the primary space I showed for the big study at the end is a completely general study where you could, in principle, be looking at a protogalactic nucleus.
What's the lowest mass? Work
for. That's best answered by n-body simulation, so I'll let Simon handle that.
We can
that
discuss
one.
That
I mean,
tomorrow.
So down to a few thousand solar masses, you kind of get something, you know. But if five stars collide to form a 200 solar mass object,
for solving the problem of the gravity center,
then the question is, what's the minimum mass of the intermediate mass black hole you need so that the late phase of InSpiral is still fast enough to inject the young stars as deep as you want them? And that's, according to what I've seen, around 1,000 solar masses.
One last quick.
If you have normal initial conditions. Yeah. If you make them initially collisional, like Simon does, in principle, you can convert the whole star cluster into a black hole.
We just have time for one or two very quick last questions. So first, Oleg.
No.
And also
Yes. No. Yes. No, because these calculations stop before the black hole really forms. I mean, we end when we have something that's grown to whatever, 1,000 solar masses, and that's when this stops. Okay, now if you want to continue and actually say that this becomes an intermediate mass black hole, there's still stars around it, and what's the later evolution? I think that is really best addressed by direct n-body stimulation. Simon has done a little bit of that, he showed in his talk, and we were talking over the break about, you know, maybe other people should be doing that.
Let me ask the last question, I think I've earned it. Do the results on runaway growth depend on the initial binary properties of the massive stars?
No. The answer is the answer is no.
One or two words from you, Simon?
No.
Okay.
You see? We agree.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again. Thank Fred again. Our next talk is by Yuri Levin, Intermediate Mass Black Holes versus Accretion Disks, Evidence from Stellar Orbits.
I want to take another minute of my time to ask Fred another question. So,
but you get the microphone to
Fred,
do it.
Does anyone ever see this million solar mass clusters in normal non-starburst galaxies? But they're all in mergers, right?
In mergers and in starburst environments.
Right, but we're not. We're not a merger, we're not a star. Okay, but where was 6 million years ago? I mean, if you look at the nuclei of other galaxies, do you ever see, you know, which has sort of nucleus like ours? Do we ever see things like this?
Well,